deepening blaze of the enormous sun. The leaves rattled dryly on the live oaks, and when a breeze sprang up in the evenings, the matted jungles of sugarcane in the country beyond the concrete walks and trolley lines were felled now by the heavy knife, and in the evenings the great high-wheeled carts groaned along the rutted tracks, piled high with the fetid sweet burden, and far off across the flat black fields laid bare by the knife, under the saffron sky, some nigger sang sadly about the transaction between him and Jesus. Out at the university on the practice field, the toe of some long-legged, slug-footed, box-shouldered lad kept smacking the leather over and over, and farther away scrimmage surged and heaved to the sound of shouts and peremptory whistles. On Saturday nights, under the glare of the battery of lights, the stadium echoed to the roar of, "Tom! Tom! Tom! Yeah! Tom!" For Tom Stark carried the ball, Tom Stark wheeled the end, Tom Stark knifed the line, and it was Tom, Tom, Tom. The sports writer said he was better than ever. Meanwhile, he was making his old man sweat. The boss was dour as a teetotaling Scot, and the office force walked on tiptoe, and girls suddenly burst out crying over their typewriters after they'd been in to take dictation, and state officials coming out of the inner room laid a handkerchief to the pallid brow with one hand, and with the other groped across the long room under the painted eyes of all the gilt-framed dead governors. Only Sadie suffered no change. She bit her syllables off the way a seamstress snaps off the thread and looked at the boss with her dark, unquenched glance, like the spirit of the future meditating on your hopeful plans. The only times the boss got the black dog off his shoulder those days were at the games. I went with him a couple of times, and when Tom uncorked his stuff, the boss was a changed man. His eyes would bug and gleam, and he would slap me on the back and grab me like a bear. There might be a flicker of that left the next morning when he opened the Sunday sporting page, but it certainly didn't last out the week. And Tom was not doing a thing to make up to the old man for the trouble he'd caused. They had high words once or twice because Tom would slack off on his training and had had a row with Billy Martin, the coach. "What the hell's it to you?" Tom demanded, standing there in the middle of the hotel room, his feet apart as though he were on a swaying deck, and his head wreathed in the cigar smoke of the place. "What the hell's it to you, or Martin either, so long as I can put him across? And I can put him across, see, I can still put him across, and what the hell else do you want? I can put him across, and you can big shot around about it. That's what you want, isn't it?" And with those remarks, Tom Stark went out and slammed the door, probably leaving the boss paralyzed with the rush of blood to his head. "That's what he said to me," the boss told me. "By God, that's what he said, and I ought to slapped him down." But he was shaken, you could see that all right. Meanwhile, the boss had handled the Sybil Fry business. I had, as I said, no part in it. What happened was, however, simple and predictable. There had been two ways to get at McMurphy, Judge Irwin and Gummy Larson. The boss had tried to scare the judge, and that had failed. So now he had to buy Gummy. He could buy Gummy because Gummy was a businessman, strictly business. He would sell anything for the proper figure, immortal soul or mother's sainted bones, and his old friend McMurphy was neither. If Gummy told McMurphy to lay off, that he wasn't going to be senator, McMurphy would lay off because without Gummy, McMurphy was nothing. The boss had no choice. He had to buy. He might have dealt directly with McMurphy and have let McMurphy go to the Senate with the intention of following up himself when the next senatorial election rolled around. But there were two arguments against that. First, the timing would have been bad. Now was the time for the boss to step out. Later on, he'd be just another senator getting on toward 50. Now he would be a boy wonder breathing brimstone. He would have a future. Second, if he let McMurphy climb back on the gravy train, a lot of people on whose brows the cold sweat would break now, if even in the privacy of the boudoir the mere thought of crossing the boss should dawn on them, would figure that you could buck the boss and get away with it. They would begin to make friends and swap cigars with friends of McMurphy. They would even begin to get ideas of their own. But there was a third argument, too, against doing business with McMurphy. It was, rather, not an argument. It was simply a fact. The fact was that the boss was the way he was. If McMurphy had forced him into a compromise, at least McMurphy shouldn't be the one to profit by it. So he did business with Gummy Larson. The figure was not cheap. It was not peanuts. It was the medical center contract, the general contract. It would be arranged that Larson would get the contract. But I had nothing to do with the arranging. Duffy did that, for he'd been pulling all along for such an arrangement, and I suppose that he must have got some sort of private kickback or sweetening from Larson. Well, I don't begrudge him that. He'd worked for it. He had cringed and sweated and felt the baleful, speculative stare of the boss on him in the long silence after he had tried to sell the idea of Gummy Larson. It wasn't his fault that an accident now made the deal possible and not his own conscientious efforts. So I don't begrudge him his sweetening. All of this went on behind my back, or perhaps even under my eyes, for in those days, as fall came on, I felt as though I were gradually withdrawing from the world around me. It could go its way, and I would go mine. Or I would have gone my way if I had known what it was. I toyed with the thought of going away, of saying to the boss, "Boss, I'm getting the hell away from here and never coming back." I could afford to do it, I thought. I didn't have to lift a finger for my morning sinker and Java. Maybe I wouldn't be rich, but I figured I was going to be rich in a nice, genteel southern way. Nobody down here ever wants to be rich, for that, of course, would be crass and vulgar. So I was going to be just genteel rich. As soon as they wound up the judge's estate, if they ever did, for his affairs were complicated and it was going to take some time. I was going to be genteel rich, for I had inherited the fruit of the judge's crime, just as someday I would inherit from my mother the fruit of the scholarly attorney's weakness, the money he had left with her when he learned the truth and just walked away. On the proceeds of the judge's old crime, I would be able to go away and lead a nice, clean, blameless life, in some place where you sit under a striped awning beside a marble-topped table and drink vermouth, cassis and soda, and look out over the wimpling, dimpling, famous sunlit blue of the sea. But I didn't go. True, since I had lost both my fathers, I felt as though I could float effortlessly away like a balloon when the last cord is cut. But I would have to go on the money from Judge Irwin. And that particular money, which would have made the trip possible, was at the same time, paradoxically enough, a bond that held me here. To change the image, it was a long cable to an anchor, and the anchor flukes clung and bit away down there in the seaweed and ooze of a long time past. Perhaps I was a fool to feel that way about my little inheritance. Perhaps it was no different from any other inheritance anybody had. Perhaps the Emperor Vespasian was right when, jingling in his jeans the money which had been derived from a tax on urinals, he wittily remarked, "Pecunia non olet." I didn't go away, but I was out of the swim of things and sat in my office or out at the university library and read books and monographs on taxation, for I now had a nice, clean assignment to work on, a tax bill. I knew so little of what was going on that it wasn't until the arrangement was an accomplished fact that I knew anything about it. I went up to the mansion one night with my briefcase full of notes and charts to have a session with the boss. The boss was not alone. Back there in the library with him were Tiny Duffy, Sugar Boy, and to my surprise, Gummy Larson. Sugar Boy sat over in a corner, hunched in a chair and holding a glass between both hands the way a child holds a glass. Out of the glass he would take little finicking sips, after each sip lifting his head up the way a chicken does when it drinks. Sugar Boy wasn't a drinker. He was afraid, he said, it might make him nervous. It would have been awful if Sugar Boy got so nervous he couldn't bust jelly glasses every shot when you threw them up in the air for him, or couldn't wipe a mule's nose with the rear fender of the black Cadillac. Duffy, of course, was a drinker, but he wasn't drinking that night. He obviously was not in any mood for drinking, even if in fleeting glimpses one caught a glimmer of triumph mixed with the acute discomfort he was experiencing as he stood in the open space in front of the big leather couch. The discomfort was due, in part at least, to the fact that the boss was very definitely drinking. For when the boss really drank, what tender inhibitions ordinarily shackled up his tongue were absolutely removed. And now he was drinking all right. It looked like the first fine flush of a 3-day blow and the barometer falling. He was cocked back on the leather couch with a pitcher of water, a bottle, and a bowl of ice on the floor beside his crumpled coat and empty shoes. When the boss really got the works, he usually took off his shoes. He was sock feet drunk now. The bottle was a long way down. Mr. Larson stood back from the foot of the couch, a middle-sized, middle-aged, compact, gray-faced, gray-suited, unimaginative-looking man. He did not drink. He had once been a gambling house operator and had found that it didn't pay to drink. Gummy was strictly business, and he didn't do anything unless it paid. As I entered and took in the layout, the boss put his already red-rimmed gaze on me, but didn't say a word until I approached the open space in front of the couch. Then he flung out an arm to indicate Tiny, who stood in the middle of that unprotected open space, with a wan smile on his tallow.
"Look," the boss said to me, pointing. "He was the one gonna fix it up with Larson, and what'd I tell him? I told him hell no, hell no, I told him I'd be damned first, and what happened?"
I took that as a rhetorical question and said nothing. I could see that the tax bill was out for the evening and started sliding back the way I'd come.
"And what happened?"
the boss bellowed at me.
"How do I know?" I asked,
but with that cast present I had begun to have a fair notion of the nature of the drama. The boss swung his head toward Tiny.
"Tell him," he commanded. "Tell him, and tell him how puking smart you feel."
Tiny didn't manage it. All he managed was the wan smile like a winter dawn above the expanse of expensive black tailoring and the white piped waistcoat and diamond pin.
"Tell him."
Tiny licked his lips and glanced shyly as a bride at the impassive, gray-faced gummy, but he didn't manage it.
"Well, I'll tell you," the boss said. "Gummy Larson is going to build my hospital and Tiny fix it up like he's been trying to do, and everybody's happy."
"That's fine," I said.
"Yeah, everybody is happy," the boss said, "except me. Except me,"
he repeated and struck himself heavily on the chest.
"For I'm the one said to Tiny, hell no, I won't deal with Larson. For I'm the one wouldn't let Larson come in this room when Tiny got him here. For I'm the one ought to driven him out of this state long ago. And where is he now? Where is he now?"
I looked over at Gummy Larson, whose gray face didn't show a thing. Way back in the old days, when I had first known Gummy and he had been a gambling house operator, the police had beat him up one time. Probably because he got behind in his protection money. They'd worked over his face until it looked like uncooked hamburger. But that had healed up now. He had known it would heal up and had taken the beating without opening his trap, because it always paid to keep your trap shut. It had paid him in the end. Eventually, he was a rich contractor and not a gambling house operator. He was a rich contractor because he'd finally made the right connections in the city hall and because he knew how to keep his mouth shut. Now he stood there on the floor and took everything the boss was throwing at him. Because it paid. Gummy had the instincts of a businessman, all right.
"I'll tell you where he is," the boss said. "Look, there he is, right in this room. Standing right there and look at him. He's a beauty, ain't he? Know what he's just done? He has just sold out his best pal. He has just sold out McMurphy."
Larson might have been standing in church, waiting for the benediction, for all his face showed.
"Oh, but that isn't anything. Not a thing, not for Gummy,"
who didn't twitch a muscle.
"Oh, not for Gummy. The only difference between him and Judas Iscariot is that Gummy would have got some boot with that 30 pieces of silver. Oh, Gummy would sell out anything. He sold out his best pal, and I...
He struck himself savagely on the chest with a hollow sound like a thump on a barrel.
And I had to buy. The sons of bitches made me buy.
He relapsed into silence, glowered across at Gummy, then reached down for the bottle. He poured a lot into the glass and sloshed in some water. He wasn't bothering with ice now. He was nearly down to essentials. Before long, the water would go. Gummy, from the vast distance of sobriety and victory and the moral certainty which comes from an accurate knowledge of exactly to the penny what everything in the whole world is worth, surveyed the figure on the couch, and when the pitcher had been set back down, said, "If we've got our business arranged, Governor, I think I'll be on my way." "Yeah," the boss said, "yeah," and swung his sock feet to the floor. "Yeah, it's arranged, by God, but..." He stood up, clutching the glass in one hand, and shook himself like a big dog, so that some of the liquor sloshed from the glass. "Listen here." He started across to Larson, sock feet heavy on the rug, head thrust out. Tiny Duffy wasn't exactly in the way, but he didn't give back fully enough, or perhaps with enough alacrity. Anyway, the boss nearly brushed him in passing, or perhaps did brush him. At that instant, without even looking at his target, the boss flung the liquid in his glass full in Duffy's face, and in one motion simply let the glass fall to the floor. It bounced on the rug, not breaking. I could see Duffy's face at the moment of contact, the big pie face of surprise, which reminded me of the time years before when the boss had scared Duffy off the platform at Upton at the barbecue and Duffy had fallen over the edge. Now, after the surprise, there was the flash of fury, then the merely humble and aggrieved expression and the placating whine. "What made you go and do that now, boss? What made you go and do that?" And the boss, who had passed him, turned at that, looked at Duffy, and said, "I ought to done it long ago. I ought to done it long ago." Then he moved to Larson, who, unperturbed by the goings-on, had picked up his coat and hat and stood waiting for the dust to settle. The boss stood directly in front of him, the bodies almost touching. Then he seized Larson by the lapels and thrust his own flushed face down to the gray one. "Arranged," he said. "Yeah, it's arranged, but you leave one window latch off. You leave one piece of iron out of that concrete. You put in one extra teaspoon of sand. You chip one piece of marble, and by God, I'll rip you open. I'll..." And still clutching the lapels, he jerked his hands apart sideways. A button from Larson's coat, which had been buttoned up, spun across the room and bounced on the hearth with a little click. "For it's mine," the boss said. "You hear? That's my hospital. It's mine." Then there wasn't any other sound but the boss's breathing. Duffy, the damp handkerchief with which he had sponged himself still clutched in his hand, regarded the scene with awe and horror on his face. Sugar Boy wasn't paying the slightest attention. Meanwhile, Larson stood there, the boss's hand still gripping the lapels, and didn't blink an eye. I had to hand it to Gummy. He didn't quiver. He had ice water in his veins. Nothing fazed him, not insult or anger or violence or getting his face beat into a hamburger. He was a true businessman. He knew the value of everything. He stood there under the heavy, flushed face, no doubt feeling the hot, alcoholic breath rasp on his own face, and waited. Then the boss released his hold. He simply opened his hands in midair, fingers spread, and stepped back. He turned his back and walked away from the spot as though it were vacant. His socked feet made no sound, and his head swayed ever so little as he moved. He sat on the couch and leaned forward with his elbows on his spread knees, the forearms hanging forward, and stared into the embers on the hearth as though he were absolutely alone. Larson, without a word, walked to the door, opened it, and went out, leaving it ajar. Tiny Duffy, with the peculiar impression of lightness, the lightness of a drowned, bloated body swaying slowly upward on the ninth day, which a fat man can give when he tiptoes, moved toward the door, too. Once there, with his hand on the knob, he looked back. As his eyes rested on the unregarding boss, the fury flashed again into the face, and just for that instant I thought, by God, he's human. Then he caught my gaze on him and looked back at me with a kind of suffering mute appeal, which asked to be forgiven for everything, asked for my understanding and sympathy, asked for everybody to think well of poor old Tiny Duffy, who had done what he could according to his lights, and then they threw stuff in his face. Didn't he have his rights? Didn't poor old Tiny have his feelings? Then he followed Larson off into the night. He managed to close the door without a sound. I looked at the boss, who hadn't stirred. "Glad I got here for the last act," I said, "but I got a toddle now. There certainly wouldn't be any talk about the tax bill."
"Wait," he said.
He reached down for the bottle and took a drag out of it. He was down to essentials now.
"I told him," he said, glaring up at me. "I told him, I said, if you leave off a window latch, I said, if you leave one iron out of the concrete, I said, if you..."
"Yeah," I said, "I heard you."
"If you put one extra teaspoon of sand, you do a thing, a single thing, and I'll rip you wide open. I'll rip you."
He got up and came toward me. He stood very close to me.
"I'll rip him," he said, and breathed heavily.
"So you said," I agreed.
"I told him I would, and I will. Let him do one thing wrong."
"All right."
"I'll rip him anyway, by God."
He flung his arms out wide.
"I'll rip him anyway. I'll rip all of them. All of them who put their dirty hands on it. They do the job, and when it's over, I'll rip them. Every one. I'll rip them and ruin them. By God, I will. Putting their dirty hands on it, for they made me. They made me do it."
"Tom Stark had something to do with it," I said. That stopped him, as far gone as he was. He stared at me with a look that made me think he was about to lay hands on me. Then he turned from me and moved back toward the couch, but he didn't sit down. He leaned over for the bottle, did it some direct damage, stared at me again, and said indistinctly,
"He's just a boy."
I didn't say anything to that. He took another try at the bottle.
"He's just a boy," he repeated dully.
"All right," I said.
"But the others," he burst out, swinging his arms wide again. "The others, they made me do it. I'll rip them. I'll ruin them."
He had quite a lot to say along that line before he took his dive into the sofa. After he got there, he made a few more muffled remarks along the same line and about how Tom Stark was just a boy. Then the one-sided conversation died away, and there wasn't anything but the heavy draw and puff of his breathing. I stood there and looked down at him, and thought about the first time, God knows how many years before, when he'd got drunk in my hotel room at Upton and passed out. He'd come a long way, and it wasn't the chubby boy face of Cousin Willie I looked down into now. Everything was changed now. It sure God was. Sugar Boy, who had sat quiet all that time over in the shadow with his short legs barely reaching the floor, got off his chair and came over to the couch. He looked down at the boss. "He's out deader than a mackerel," I said to him. He nodded, still looking down at the burly form. The boss was lying on his back. One leg was off the couch, dragging on the floor. Sugar Boy leaned to pick it up and adjust it on the couch. Then he saw the discarded coat on the floor. He picked that up and spread it over the boss's sock feet. He looked at me and explained almost apologetically.
"He might catch cold."
I gathered up my briefcase and top coat and moved toward the door. I looked back at the scene of carnage. Sugar Boy had gone back to his chair in the shadow. I must have had some trace of question in my look, for he said,
"I'll set up and see nobody bothers him."
So I left them together. As I drove down the night street on my way home, I wondered what Adam Stanton would have to say if he ever learned about how the hospital was going to be built. I knew what the boss would say, however, if the question about Adam were put up to him. He'd say,
"Hell, I said I'd build it, and I'm building it. That's the main thing, I'm building it. Let him stay in it and keep his own little patties sterile as hell."
which was exactly what he did say when I asked him the question. And as I drove down the night street, I wondered what Ann Stanton would have to say if she had been there in that room and had seen the boss piled up there, out blind on the couch. I took some sardonic pleasure in that speculation. If she had taken up with him because he was so big and tough and knew his own mind and was willing to pay the price for anything, well, she ought to see him piled up there like a bull that's got tangled up in the lead rope and is down on its knees and can't budge and can't even lift its head anymore on account of the ring in the nose. She ought to see that. Then I thought that maybe that was what she was waiting for. There's nothing women love so much as the drunkard, the hellion, the roarer, the reprobate. They love him because they, women I mean, are like the bees in Samson's parable in the Bible. They like to build their honeycomb in the carcass of a dead lion. Out of the strong shall come forth sweetness.
This ends Disc 15. All the King's Men, Disc 16.
Tom Stark may have been just a boy, as the boss said, but he had had a good deal to do with the way things were going. But then the boss had had a good deal to do, I suppose, with making Tom what Tom was. So there was a circle in the proof, and the son was merely an extension of the father, and when they glared at each other, it was like a mirror looking into a mirror. As a matter of fact, they did look alike. The same cock to the head on the shoulders, the same forward thrust of the head, the same sudden gestures. Tom was a trained-down, slick-faced, confident, barbered version of what the boss had been a long time back when I first knew him. The big difference was this. Back in those days, the boss had been blundering and groping his unwitting way toward the discovery of himself, of his great gift, wearing his overalls that bagged down about the seat, or the blue serge suit with the tight, shiny pants, nursing some blind and undefined compulsion within him like fate or a disease. Now, Tom wasn't blundering and groping toward anything, and certainly not toward a discovery of himself. For he knew that he was the damnedest, hottest thing there was. Tom Stark, all American. And there were no flies on him, and no overalls bagged down about his snake hips and pile driver knees. No, he would stand in his rubber-soled saddle shoes in the middle of the floor with a boxer's stance, the gray-striped sport coat draped over his shoulders, the top button of his heavy-weave white shirt unbuttoned, the red wool tie tied in a loose, hanging knot as big as your fist under his bronze-looking throat, jerked over to one side, though, and his confident eyes would rove slowly over the joint, and his slick, strong brown jaw would move idly over the athlete's chewing gum. You know how athletes chew gum. Oh, he was the hero, all right, and he wasn't blundering or groping. He knew what he was. He knew he was good, so he didn't have to bother to keep all the rules, not even the training rules. He could deliver anyway, he told his father, so what the hell? But he did it once too often. He and Thad Mellon, who was a substitute tackle, and Gup Lawson, who was a regular guard, did themselves proud one Saturday night after the game out at a roadhouse. They might have managed very well if they hadn't got into a fight with some yokels who didn't know or care much about football, and who resented having their girls fooled with. Gup Lawson took quite a beating from the yokels and went to the hospital and was out of football for several weeks. Tom and Thad didn't get more than a few punches before the crowd broke up the fight. But the breach of rules was dumped rather dramatically into the lap of Coach Billy Martin. It got into one of the papers. He suspended Tom Stark and Thad Mellon. That definitely changed the betting odds for the Georgia game for the following Saturday, for Georgia was good that year, and Tom Stark was the local edge. The boss took it like a man. No kicking and screaming, even when Georgia wound up the half with the score 7-0. As soon as the whistle blew, he was on his feet. "Come on," he said to me, and I knew he was on his way to the field house. I trailed him down there and leaned against a door jamb and watched it. Back off on the field, there was the band music now. The band would be parading around with the sunshine, for this was the first of the afternoon games, now that the season was cooling off, glittering on the brass and on the whirling gold baton of the leader. Then the band, way off there, began to tell dear old State how we loved her, how we'd fight, fight, fight for her, how we'd die for her, how she was the mother of heroes. Meanwhile, the heroes, pretty grimy and winded, lay around and got worked over. The boss didn't say a word at first. He just walked into the place and looked slowly around over the relaxed forms. The atmosphere would have reminded you of a morgue. You could have heard a pin drop. There wasn't a sound except once the scrape of a cleat on the concrete when somebody surreptitiously moved his foot, once or twice the creak of harness when somebody shifted his position. Coach Billy Martin, standing over across the room with his hat jammed down to his eyes, looked glum and chewed an unlit cigar. The boss worked his eyes over them all, one by one, while the band made its promises and the old grads in the stands stood up in the beautiful autumn light with their hats over their hearts and felt high and pure. The boss's eyes came to rest on Jimmy Hardwich, who was sitting on a bench. Jimmy was a second-string end. He'd been put in at the second quarter because the regular at left end had been performing like a constipated dowager. It was going to be Jimmy's big chance. The chance came. It was a pass, and he dropped it. So now, when the boss's eyes fixed on Jimmy, Jimmy stared sullenly back. Then, when the boss's eyes lingered a moment, Jimmy burst out, "God damn it! God damn it! Go on and say it!" But the boss didn't say it. He didn't say anything. He just moved slowly over to stand in front of Jimmy. Then, very deliberately, he reached out and laid his right hand on Jimmy's shoulder. He didn't pat the shoulder, he just laid it there, the way some men can do to gentle a nervous horse. He wasn't looking at Jimmy now, but swept his glance around over all the others. "Boys," he said, "I just came down to tell you I know you did your best." He stood there with his hands still lying on Jimmy's shoulder and let that sink in. Jimmy began to cry. Then he said, "And I know you will do your best, for I know the stuff you got in you." He waited again. Then he took his hand off Jimmy's shoulder and turned slowly and moved toward the door. There he paused and again swept his glance over the room. "I want to tell you I won't forget you," he said and walked out the door. Jimmy was really crying now. I followed the boss back outside, where the band was now playing some brassy march. When the second half opened up, the boys came out for blood. They made a touchdown early in the third quarter and kicked the point. The boss felt pretty good, in a grim way, about that. In the fourth quarter, Georgia drove down to the danger zone, was held, then kicked a field goal. That was the way it ended, 10-7. But we still had a shot at the conference, if we took everything else in the season. The next Saturday, Tom Stark was back out. He was out because the boss had put the heat on Billy Martin. That was why, all right, for the boss told me so himself. "How did Martin take it?" I asked. "He didn't," the boss said. "I crammed it down his throat." I didn't say anything to that and didn't even know I was looking anything. But the boss thrust his head at me and said, "Now look here. I wasn't going to let him throw it away. We got a chance for the conference and the bastard would throw it away." I still didn't say anything. "It's not Tom, it's the championship, by God," he said. "It's not Tom. If it weren't anything but Tom, I wouldn't say a word, and if he breaks training again, I'll pound his head on the floor. I'll beat him with my own hands, I swear it." "He's a pretty good-sized boy," I remarked. He swore again he would do it. So the next Saturday, Tom Stark was back out. And he carried the ball, and he was a cross between a ballerina and a locomotive. And the stands cheered, "Yay, Tom, Tom, Tom," for he was their darling. And the score was 20-0, and State had the sights back on the championship. There were two more games. There was an easy one with Tech, and then the Thanksgiving payoff. Tech was easy. In the third quarter, when State already had a lead, the coach sent Tom in just to give him a canter. Tom put on a little show for the stands. It was casual and beautiful and insolent. There was nothing to it, the way he did his stuff. It looked so easy. But once, after he had knifed through for 7 yards and had been nailed by the secondary, he didn't get up right away. "Just got the breath knocked out," the boss said. And Tiny Duffy, who was with us in the governor's box, said, "Sure, but it won't faze old Tom. Hell no, the boss agreed. But Tom didn't get up at all. They picked him up and carried him to the field house.
They sure knocked it out of him,
the boss said as though he were commenting on the weather.
Then, look, they're putting in Axton. Axton's pretty good. Give him another season.
He's good, but he ain't Tom Stark. That Tom Stark is my boy, Duffy proclaimed.
They'll pass now, I bet, the boss said judicially, but all the time he was sneaking a look at the procession making for the field house. Axton for Stark, the loudspeaker up above the stands bellowed, and the cheerleader called for the stuff for Stark. They gave Tom his cheer, and the leader and the assistant leaders cartwheeled and cavorted and flung up their megaphones. The ball went back into play. It was a pass, just as the boss had predicted. 9 yards and first down.
First down on Tech's 24-yard line, the loudspeaker announced, then added, Tom Stark, who was stunned on the previous play, shows signs of regaining consciousness.
Stunned, huh? Tiny Duffy echoed. Then he slapped the boss on the shoulder. He loved to slap the boss on the shoulder in public to show what buddies they were, and said,
They can't stun our old Tom, huh?
The boss's face darkened for a moment, but he said nothing.
Not for long, Tiny asseverated. That boy, he's too tough for him.
He's tough, the boss agreed. Then he gave his attention with the greatest devotion to the game. The game was dull, but the duller it got, the more devoutly the boss followed every play, and the more anxious he was to cheer. State ground out the touchdowns like a butcher's machine making hamburger. There was about as much sporting chance in the process as in betting on whether or not water runs downhill. But the boss cheered every time we made 3 yards. He'd just cheered a pass, which had put State on the 6-yard line, when a fellow appeared in front of our box and took off his hat and said,
Governor Stark? Governor Stark? Yeah, the boss asked. The doc over at the field house, he says, can you come over a minute?
The man said.
Thanks, the boss said. You tell him I'll be over in a minute, soon as I see the boys run this one over.
And he put his attention on the game.
Hell, Tiny began. I know it ain't nothing. Not old Tom, he...
Shut up, the boss commanded. Can't you see I'm watching a game? And when the touchdown had been driven over and the point had been kicked, the boss turned and said to me,
It's getting on quitting time here. You let Sugar Boy drive you to the office and wait for me there. I want to see you and Swinton. If you can get him, I'll take a cab down. Probably beat you there.
And he vaulted over the railing to the green and went toward the field house. But he stopped by the bench for a moment to kid the boys. Then, with his hat jammed down over the heavy, outthrust head, he went on toward the field house. The rest of us in the box didn't wait for the last whistle. We worked out before the rush started and headed for town. Duffy got off at the athletic club, where he kept his wind in condition by blowing the froth off beer and bending over pool tables, and I went on to the Capitol. I could tell even before I put my key to the lock that there wasn't any light in the big reception room. The girls had shut up shop and gone home for Saturday afternoon, off to their movies and bridge games and dates and steaks on sizzling platters at Ye Old Wagon Wheel Roadhouse, or dancing at the Dream of Paris where the lights were blue and the saxophone made a sound like the slow, sweet regurgitation of sorghum molasses. Off to all the chatter and jabber and giggles and whispers and gasps. Off to all the things called having a good time. For a moment, as I stood there in the big, darkened room in the unaccustomed stillness of the place, a kind of sneer flickered along the edge of my mind as I thought of all the particular good times they'd be having, the places they'd be having the good times in, Ye Old Wagon Wheel, Dream of Paris, Capital City Movie Palace, parked cars, darkened vestibules. The people they would be having the good times with, the college boy with his cocksureness and scarcely concealed air of being on a slumming expedition, the drug clerk with $900 saved up in the bank and his hope of buying into the business next year and his notion of getting him a little woman and settling down, the middle-aged sport with hair plastered thinly over the big skull veined like agate and big, damp, brutally manicured hands the color of uncooked pork fat and an odor of bay rum and peppermint chewing gum. Then as I stood there, the thought changed. But the sneer remained flickering along the edge of the mind, like a little flame nibbling at the edge of a piece of damp paper. Only now it was for myself. What right had I to sneer at them? I demanded. I had had all those good times, too. If I wasn't having one tonight, it wasn't because I had passed beyond it into a state of beatitude. Perhaps it was something had passed out of me. Virtue by defect. Abstinence by nausea. When they give you the cure, they put something in your liquor to make you puke. And after they've puked you enough, you begin to take a distaste to your liquor. You're like Pavlov's dog, whose saliva starts every time he hears the bell. Only with you, the reflex works so that every time you catch a whiff of liquor or even think of it, your stomach turns upside down. Somebody must have slipped the stuff into my good times. For now, I just didn't want any more good time. Not now, anyway. But I could pinch out that sneer that flickered along the edge of my mind. I didn't have to be proud because a good time wouldn't stay on my stomach. So I would go into my office, and after sitting there a couple of minutes in the dusk, would flick on the light and get out the tax figures and work on them. I thought of the figures with a sense of cleansing and relief. But as I thought of the figures and resumed my passage across the big room to the door of my office, I heard, or thought I heard, a noise from one of the offices on the other side. I looked over there. There wasn't any light showing under either of the doors. Then I heard the noise again. It was a perfectly real noise. Nobody, certainly nobody without a light, was supposed to be in there. So I went across the room, my feet noiseless on the thick carpet, and pushed open the door. It was Sadie Burke. She sat in the chair before her desk. It must have been the creaking of the chair I had heard. Her arms were laid on the desk, the forearms bent together, and I knew that she had, just that instant, raised her head from them. Not that Sadie had been crying, but she had been sitting in the dusk, in the abandoned office, on Saturday evening, when everybody else was out having a hell of a good time, with her head laid on her arms on the desk. "Hello, Sadie," I said. She eyed me for a moment. Her back was toward what little light seeped in from the window on which the Venetian blind was closed, so I couldn't make out the expression of her face, just the gleam of the eyes. Then she demanded, "What do you want?" "Nothing," I said. "Well, you needn't wait." I went across to a chair and sat down and looked at her. "You heard what I said," she commented. "I heard it." "Well, you'll hear it again. You needn't wait." "I find it quite restful here," I replied, making no motion to rise. "Because, Sadie, we've got so much in common, you and me." "I hope you don't mean that as a compliment," she said. "No, just a scientific observation." "Well, it don't make you any Einstein." "You mean because it's not true that we have a lot in common, or because it's so obviously true that it doesn't take Einstein's brain to figure it out?" "I mean, I don't give a damn," she said sourly, and added, "and I don't give a damn about having you in here, either." I stayed in the chair and studied her. "It's Saturday night," I said. "Why aren't you out painting the town?" "To hell with this town." She fished a cigarette out of the desk and lighted it. The flare of the match jerked the face out of shadow. She whipped the match flame out with a snapping motion of her arm, then spewed the first gulp of smoke out over the full, curled-down lower lip. That done, she looked at me and said, "And to hell with you." She swept her damning gaze around the office as though it were full of forms and faces, and spewed the gray smoke out of her lungs and said, "And to hell with all of them. To hell with this place." Her eyes came back to rest on me, and she said, "I'm going to get out of here." "Here?" I questioned. "This whole place," she affirmed, and swung her arm wide with the cigarette tip glowing with the swiftness of the motion. "This place, this town." "Stick around and you'll get rich," I said. "I could have been rich a long time back," she said, "paddling in this much, if I'd wanted to." She could have, all right, but she hadn't, at least as far as I knew. "Yeah," she jabbed out the cigarette in the tray on the desk. "I'm getting out of here." She lifted her eyes to mine, as though daring me to say something. I didn't say anything, but I shook my head. "You think I won't?" she demanded.
"I think you won't."
"I'll show you, damn you."
"No," I said and shook my head again, "you won't. You've got a talent for this, just like a fish has for swimming, and you can't expect a fish not to swim." She started to say something, but didn't. We sat there in the dimness for a couple of minutes.
"Stop staring at me," she ordered.
Then,
"Didn't I tell you to get out of here? Why don't you get out and go home?"
"I'm waiting for the boss," I said matter-of-factly. "He's..." Then I remembered. "Didn't you hear what happened?"
"What?"
"Tom Stark."
"Somebody ought to kick his teeth down his throat."
"Somebody did," I said.
"They ought to done it long back."
"Well, they did a pretty good job this afternoon. The last I heard, he was unconscious. They called the boss over to the field house."
"How bad was it?"
she asked.
"Was it bad?"
She leaned forward at me. "He was unconscious, that's all I know. I reckon they took him to the hospital."
"Didn't they say how bad? Didn't they tell the boss?"
she demanded, leaning forward. "What the hell's it to you? You said somebody ought to kick his teeth down his throat, and now they did it, you act like you loved him."
"Ha!" she said, "that's a laugh."
I looked at my watch. "The boss is late. I reckon he must be at the hospital with the triple threat." She was silent for a moment, looking down at the desktop again and gnawing the lip. Then all at once she got up, went across to the rack, put her coat on and jerked on her hat, and went to the door. I swung my head around to watch her. At the door she hesitated, throwing the latch, and said,
"I'm leaving and I want to lock up. I don't see why you can't sit in your own office anyway."
I got up and went out into the reception room. She slammed her door, and without a word to me, moved pretty fast across the place and out into the corridor. I stood there and listened to the rapid, diminishing staccato of her heels on the marble of the corridor. When it had died away, I went into my own office and sat down by the window and looked down at the river mist which was fingering in over the roofs. I wasn't, however, looking out over the mist-veiled, romantic, crepuscular city, but was bent over my nice, tidy, comforting tax figures under a green-shaded light when the telephone rang. It was Sadie. She said that she was at the University Hospital and that Tom Stark was still unconscious. The boss was there, but she hadn't seen him, but she understood he'd asked for me. So Sadie had gone over there, to lurk in the antiseptic shadows. I left the tidy, comforting tax figures and went out. I had a sandwich at a hamburger stand and a cup of coffee and drove to the hospital. I found the boss alone in a waiting room. He was looking a little grim. I asked how Tom was and learned that he was then in the X-ray room and that they didn't know much. Dr. Stanton was on the case, and some other specialist was flying in by special plane from Baltimore for a consultation. Then he said, "I want you to go out and get Lucy. She ought to be here. Out there in the country, I guess she hadn't seen the paper yet." I said I would go and started out the door. "Jack," he called, and I turned. "Sort of break it to her easy," he said, "you know. Sort of build her up for it." I said I would and left. It sounded pretty bad if Lucy had to have all that build-up, and as I drove along the highway, against the lights of the Saturday night incoming traffic, I thought how much fun it was going to be to build Lucy up for the news. And I thought the same thing again as I walked up the anachronistic patch of concrete walk toward the dimly lighted White House. Then, as I stood in the parlor, surrounded by the walnut and red plush, and the cards for the stereoscope and the malarial crayon portrait on the easel, and built Lucy up for the news, it was definitely not fun. But she took it. It hit her where she lived, but she took it.
"Oh, God," she said, not loud. "Oh, God."
Then out of the stiff white face,
"Wait a minute, I'll get my coat."
So we got into the car and drove back to town. There wasn't any conversation. Once I heard her say again,
"Oh, God."
But the remark was not addressed to me. I presumed that she was praying, for she had gone to the little Baptist college way back in the red clay where they'd been long on praying, and maybe the habit had stuck. And it wasn't fun either when I led her into the waiting room where the boss was.
He turned his face heavily to her from the midst of the floral design on the chintz-covered, overstuffed, high-backed chair in which he sat, and looked at her as at a stranger. She stood in the middle of the floor, not going toward him, and asked,
"How is he?"
At her question, the light flared up in the boss's eyes, and he rose violently from the chair. "Look here," he said. "He's all right. He's going to be all right. You understand that?"
"How is he?"
she repeated. I told you he's going to be all right," he said with a grating voice.
"You say it," she said, "but what do the doctors say?"
The blood apoplectically flushed his face, and I heard the snatch of his breathing before he said,
"You wanted it this way. You said you did. You said you'd rather see him dead at your feet. You wanted it this way, but—"
And he stepped toward her.
"He'll fool you. He's all right, do you hear? He'll be all right."
"God grant it," she said quietly.
"Grant it, grant it," he burst out. "He's all right now. That boy's tough. He can take it."
She made no answer to that, but stood and looked at him while the blood subsided in his face and his frame seemed to sag with the weight of the flesh on it. Then she asked,
"Can I see him?"
Before answering, the boss stepped back to the chair and sank into it. Then he looked at me. "Take her down to room 305, he directed. He spoke dully, and apparently without interest now, as though in a railway waiting room answering foolish questions about the schedule for some traveler. So I took her down to room 305, where the body lay like a log under the white sheet, and the breath labored through the gaping mouth. At first she didn't approach the bed. She stood just inside the door, looking across at it. I thought she was going to keel over and put my arm out to prop her, but she stayed on her legs. Then she moved to the bed and reached down with a timid motion to touch the body there. She laid her hand on the right leg, just above the ankle, and let it rest there as though she could draw or communicate some force by the contact. Meanwhile, the nurse, who stood on the other side of the bed, leaned down to wipe from the brow of the patient the drops of moisture which gathered there. Lucy Stark took a step or two up the bed and, looking at the nurse, reached out her hand. The nurse put the cloth into it, and Lucy finished the job of wiping the brow and temples. Then she handed the cloth back to the nurse.
"Thank you," she whispered.
The nurse gave a sort of smile of professional understanding out of her plain, good, anonymous, middle-aged face, like a light flicked on momentarily in a comfortable, shabby living room. But Lucy wasn't looking at that face, but at the sag-jawed face below her, where the breath labored in and out. There wasn't any light on there. So after a while, the nurse said Dr. Stanton wouldn't be back for some little time, and she would notify us when he did come. We went back to the room where the boss sat with his heavy head in the middle of the floral design. Lucy sat in another chintz-covered chair. The waiting room was very cozy and cheerful with potted plants on the window ledge and chintz on the chairs and watercolors on the walls in natural wood frames, and a fireplace with artificial logs in it, and looked at her lap or now and then across at the boss, and I sat on the couch over by the wall and thumbed through the picture magazines, from which I gathered that the world outside our cozy little nook was still the world. About 11:30, Adam came in to say that the doctor from Baltimore, who was coming for the consultation, had been forced down by fog and would fly in as soon as the ceiling lifted.
"Fog?" the boss exclaimed and came up out of the chair. "Fog, telephone him. You telephone him. Tell him to come on, fog or no fog."
"A plane can't fly in fog," Adam said.
"Telephone him. That boy in there, my boy."
The voice didn't trail off. It simply stopped with a sound like something of great weight grinding to a stop, and the boss stared at Adam Stanton with resentment and a profound accusation.
"Dr. Burnham will come when it's possible," Adam said coldly.
Then, after a moment in which he met the resentment and accusation, he said,
"Governor, I think that it would be a good thing for you to lie down to get some rest."
"No," the boss said hoarsely. "No."
"You can do no good by not lying down. You'll only waste your strength. You can do no good."
"Good," the boss said. "Good."
And clenched his hands as though he had tried to grasp some substance which had faded at his touch and dissolved to air.
"I would advise it,"
Adam said quietly, almost softly. Then he turned an inquiring glance upon Lucy. She shook her head.
"No, doctor,"
she almost whispered.
"I'll wait, too."
Adam inclined his head in acceptance and went out. I got up and followed him. I caught up with Adam down the hall.
"What's it like?" I asked.
"Bad,"
he said.
"How bad?"
"He is unconscious and paralyzed," Adam said. "His extremities are quite limp. The reflexes are quite gone. If you pick up his hand, it's like jelly. The X-ray, we took a skull plate, shows a fracture and dislocation of the 5th and 6th cervical vertebrae."
"Where the hell is that?"
Adam reached out and laid a couple of fingers on the back of my neck.
"There," he said.
"You mean he's got a broken neck?"
"Yes."
"I thought that killed them."
"It usually does," he said. "Always, if the fracture is a little higher."
"Has he got a chance?"
"Yes."
"To just live or be all right?"
"To be all right, or almost all right. Just a chance."
"What are you going to do?"
He looked at me directly, and I saw that his own face didn't look much different from the way it would have looked if somebody had kicked him in the head, too. It was white and drawn.
"It is a difficult decision," he said. "I must think. I don't want to talk about it now."
So he turned from me and squared his shoulders and went off down the hall, over the polished composition floor which glittered in the soft light like brown ice. I went back to the room where Lucy Stark sat across from the boss, in the midst of the chintz and potted plants and watercolors. Now and then she would lift her gaze from her lap, where the hands were clasped together with the veins showing blue, and would look across the intervening distance into her husband's face. He didn't meet her gaze, but stared into the heatless illumination of the artificial logs on the hearth. After 1 o'clock, a nurse came down to the room with the message that the fog had cleared and that Dr. Burnham's plane was on the way again. They would let us know as soon as it came in, then she went away. The boss sat silent for a minute or two, then said to me, "Go down and call up the airport. Ask what the weather's like here. Tell him to tell Sugar Boy I said for him to get here quick. Tell Murphy I said I meant quick. By God! By God!" And the oath was left suspended, directed at nothing. I went down the corridor and down to the telephone booths on the first floor to give that crazy message to Sugar Boy and Murphy. Sugar Boy would drive like hell anyway, and Murphy, he was the lieutenant in charge of the motorcycle escort, knew he wasn't out there for fun. But I called the port, was told that the weather was lifting, a wind had sprung up, and left the message for Murphy. When I stepped out of the booth, there was Sadie. She must have been hanging around in the lobby, probably sitting on one of the benches back in the shadow, for I hadn't seen her when I entered. "Why didn't you say boo and give me real heart failure and finish the job?" I asked.
"How is it?"
she demanded, seizing my coat sleeve.
"Bad. He broke his neck."
"Has he got any chance?"
"Dr. Stanton said he did, but he wasn't wreathed in smiles."
"What are they going to do? Operate?"
"There's another big shot doctor coming in from Johns Hopkins for a consultation. After he gets here, they'll flip a nickel and find out what to do."
"Did he sound like there was a real chance?"
Her hand was still clutching my sleeve. "How do I know?" I was suddenly irritated. I jerked my sleeve out of her grasp.
"If you find out anything, you know, when the doctor comes, will you let me know?"
she asked humbly, letting her hand fall.
"Why the hell don't you go home and quit spooking around here in the dark? Why don't you go home?"
She shook her head, still humbly.
"You want to kick his teeth down his throat and now you hang around and lose sleep? Why don't you go home?"
She shook her head slowly.
"I'll wait," she said.
"You're a sap," I affirmed.
"Let me know," she said, "when you find out anything."
I didn't even say anything to that, but walked on away, back upstairs where I rejoined the party. Things hadn't changed in the atmosphere of the room. After a spell, a nurse came back to say that the plane was expected at the port in about 30 or 40 minutes. Then, a little later, she came back to say that there was a telephone call from me. "Who is it?" I asked the nurse.